I'm Abby.
I'm Evan.
And I'm Katie.
And you're listening to The Fashion Hags.
We love to love
and love to hate
all things fashion.
Hey. Hello, it's us. We're back.
Don't know where that came from.
Well, hello.
Hi, Hags.
Oh, hello, we're back. Yes, hello, Fashion Hags, episode 80. This is very exciting.
I can't believe it's 80 already.
80? It kind of snuck up on us. I know we were in the 70s before, but then, like, boom, 80.
80 does come after the 70s.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's, I mean, good. I'm no mathematician, but...
You are? Yeah. My God.
I know.
My whole life is a lie.
Oh, man. Talk about imposter syndrome. Anyway, we're back. It's episode 80.
It's Fashion Hags.
Yes.
Podcast, in case you didn't know what you were listening to.
In case you forgot about that in the 0.5 seconds we stopped talking. We have a guest today.
Very exciting.
An internet friend who we've just met her in real life for the first time, just, you know, half an hour ago or something. Kat Sark, or Katrina Sark. Hello.
Hello.
Dr. Sark.
Thank you.
Professor Sark, yeah.
Yes, Professor. We have an actual real life.
Not professor yet, academic. But doctor.
There you go. Hey, man. That's pardon nothing me. To scoff at.
Professorships are hard to come by these days.
Yeah. Are they?
Oh, well. Well, Kat found us on the internet and reached out. Well, maybe in January? I forget when it was. They just sent us a message and we connected and...
We're like, yes, please.
You like what we're doing, and we like what you're doing, and you're in town, and it worked out. You're at my alma mater. I went to UVic.
Oh.
That's where I met my husband. I did Germanic studies.
Oh, my goodness.
I lived my life in Clearahue for 4 years.
Oh, my goodness.
What year? Maybe we've crossed
1999
paths.
To 2003.
I was there at the same time, but I was not in Germanic studies. I was doing history and English at that time. Like a floor below.
There was like no lady professors in the Germanic studies program.
It was all
back in those
white
days.
Guys.
Yeah.
Or younger, also white guys. But anyway.
It has changed since. It's mostly female dominated now, and the females are kicking some good ass.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
That's good, good to hear.
Yeah, I did French and German at UVic, which is kind of a weird thing to do at UVic, but I loved Victoria and didn't want to leave.
It's cozy.
It was real nice, and it was a nice little spot to get my degree, and which I then don't use, but that's neither here nor there.
You use it every day.
That's true. Yeah.
You gained a lot of knowledge.
I don't speak French or German, and pretty much ever, but those other skills.
They're in there.
Yeah, rattling around in there.
Give yourself some credit.
It's subconscious. It comes out in ways.
In other words, the transferable skills, right? Exactly.
Did we mention exactly what you do and how we connected? Because we jumped right into university, but I don't think we actually mentioned what you do. Can you elaborate?
Yes.
Let us all know.
So I'm teaching at the University of Victoria right now as a sessional instructor. That means I'm on contract and I teach in multiple departments. I do mostly media studies, cultural studies, and gender studies, but I also teach some German when
the need arises.
When the need arises and I need to basically hustle and get some more courses. And the department is really good to me, but there is no full-time work for me, but I've been on the side.
You got that side hustle going, right?
Always.
Always.
Parallel to that, I've been working on fashion in different ways. I started the Canadian Fashion Scholars Network 5 years ago while I was still working on my PhD and living in Montreal and researching a book called Montreal Chic, which is basically telling the story of culture in Montreal through the lens of fashion. So it's part of a book series that I started with a friend and colleague of mine. Her name is Susan Ingram. She's based at York University in Toronto, and she's the editor of the whole book series. So we started collaborating back in 2005 when I was doing my master's. I was writing about cities and cultures, and I was doing a master's in Berlin. And she had asked me to go and look at a fashion museum. So there was a catalog called Berliner Schick that proclaimed a new fashion museum in Berlin, telling the story of the city through fashion. And so I went and I started looking for the fashion exhibition, and it was gone. So I started I started investigating, and I was sent to the outskirts of Berlin to a warehouse where the whole exhibition was packed up into boxes, where sadly it remains to this day, because there is some politics going on in how museal spaces are distributed and what is considered art, for example, where fashion is really very much on the bottom of that priority list. And so as I started researching, specifically, I was researching the city of Berlin for my academic work, but I was researching the fashion of Berlin parallel, which then became the first book in the Urban Chick book series. It became clear that someone needs to tell that story, because no one really was looking for that story, for the exhibition, for the stuff that kind of disappeared overnight. And so even though I was just starting my PhD and I had never written books before, I kind of felt after meeting the women who had basically spent their lives collecting, preserving, trying to build a museum, trying to fight to get the funding to have the story told, not have it available to people, I kind of felt a personal responsibility to be able to tell that story. So I kind of fell into fashion in this really weird way through this history of the city that was bombed, divided, reunited, reconstructed, completely gentrified, and turned into a fashion hub again. And so it became this really, really interesting story. But at the heart of it was women's labor, essentially, because
It's women's work.
Yes, always. Especially in a city that basically the survivors after World War II were mostly women.
Yeah.
And so they, you know, like they were sewing clothes from...
That was the skills they had.
From whatever was left over that the Soviets didn't ship over to Soviet Russia as a means of reparation. So there was a lot of repurposing happening.
Oh, sure.
And so all of these kinds of like historical pieces from the beginning kind of like of the fashion industry in Europe. So back from when Singer basically started mass producing machines, the machines coming into homes and allowing mass produced clothing, that industry started in Berlin. And so you had this very rich social, cultural, and even political history that can be told through clothing that was not available to anybody. And so having met with these curators, with these archivists, with these women who used to work, for example, in the East Berlin, in the GDR Fashion Institute, that was then amalgamated into West Berlin museal culture and kind of like distribution of clothing, or distribution of how culture is presented, they wanted to tell their story. And there was no outlet to tell that story.
Hell of a story.
Yeah.
I say, like, of all the cities to have fallen into that that kind of niche and that kind of part of history, that sort of
that
channel
story,
history. I mean, Berlin is such a historically significant city just on the base level of things. Like,
absolutely.
I mean, it must have been like,
and it's interesting because it had such a turbulent history. It was ups and downs. So we hear a lot about Berlin in the 20s and kind of like the artificial silk being produced and kind of like all these like clothing companies being produced. And of course, a lot of them were Jewish. And so that history dies down in the 30s. And then unfortunately, all of them were exterminated during the war and during the Holocaust. And there's beautiful memorials actually now in Berlin where There's one part of town in the city center where there's a memorial that are three mirrors kind of like facing in and out. So you can stand inside of it and kind of like be surrounded in this square where they used to have these Jewish owned department stores that were destroyed and bombed out and of course Aryanized by the Nazis.
Oh, sure, yeah. And they were given back once the, well, you know, they were done.
No. So, and it's, there's a metro station, and when you come out of the metro on the steps, you have the names and the addresses of the couturiers who used to be around that square. And of course, when Berlin was bombed out, everything was flattened.
That's it. Right.
So you have brand new condo buildings all around. So that's kind of like a memorial site that is interesting because you can't see, only in pictures or old photographs, you can see what it used to look like. But then there's an active memorialization effort happening in Germany and in Berlin. And the fashion industry plays a major role in that because so many, the whole industry was existed because of the Jewish community in Berlin that no longer existed after 1933-34. And so that story kind of ends there. It gets picked up again right after the war. The first fashion shows, fashion magazines, and fashion designers came back from the war and basically started catering to the Allied forces who were occupying Berlin. And the first magazine came out in October 1945.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Which is, I mean, the Battle of Berlin was April 1945. Yeah. So the Russians had Berlin for that whole summer. And then the Americans came in June or something like that. So by October, you already had people making clothes out of whatever scraps they could find and selling it to the officer, to the Allied officers' wives.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, and then you have, of course, like the division of Berlin in the 1960s. So the industry got built up again in the 50s, thanks to the Marshall Plan and the American money that was invested into rebuilding Europe. And then it stops again because the wall is now dividing.
Yeah.
I mean, you wake up one day and there's a wall and you can no longer go to work.
Oh, my God. That's right. What a crazy.
It stops again. And it so it moved from West Berlin to, I think, Dortmund or Düsseldorf, one of those cities. But the GDR Fashion Institute was still in East Berlin, and it kind of set the tone and supplied the designs, the kind of like the distribution plans for all of East Germany, but then also the Eastern Bloc countries. So there were exchanges and fashion shows where the East German designers would go and present in Moscow and vice versa. And they were making the Olympic uniforms and the kind of like the soccer uniforms for all of the GDR, I guess, like athletes. And then, of course, then stewardesses and like all these others. So they were the official fashion design, responsible for all of fashion design in Eastern.
Like, you don't always hear about Eastern German fashion.
Not
usually what you hear about.
So all of that knowledge, all of this material is now housed
in a warehouse. Oh, what a heartbreaker.
Closed up in the boxes.
Exactly.
So if you want to even tell that story, if you want to do this research, you have to, A, know some German, find this warehouse, go there, have access. As an academic, you have access to these spaces. Mm-hmm. So even though it's not completely open to the public, it's still accessible.
You have an in, yeah.
It is accessible. And so, it's a very slow process to be able to even tell that kind of a story. And it put a lot of weight on my shoulders back in 2005 where I couldn't just leave after I finished my master's and I couldn't just leave and just say, okay, nice knowing you. Thanks for sharing. Yeah. I'm going to go now and live my life back in Canada. And so, yeah, I had started my PhD in Montreal and then it stayed with me. It lived with me for a whole year until I finally said, We need to write a book.
It's not going anywhere. It's still ticking away.
Yes. And I was waiting for someone else to write that book.
Sure. The necessity of the story to be told is still there.
Yes. I was waiting for someone more experienced to do that.
Oh, you silly. Just do it.
So finally, I realized that no one else is going to those warehouses.
Oh, that's great. And that's that turned into a series of books with like,
yes.
What do they call it? Locational history?
Urban Chic books. The subtitles are always Berliner Chic, the locational history of Berlin. And then because I lived in Montreal for 8 years, after Berlin came out, Susan and her partner, Marcus, who's Viennese, they wanted to work on Vienna, and I helped them with the research for that.
Another city you don't
exactly
put fashion with. Like you're saying, these aren't fashion capitals or anything.
Yeah, but they're not traditional fashion capitals.
Yeah. Look at these amazing stories and rich histories that
are so fascinating.
Never know about.
Mm-hmm. And same with Montreal. I mean, I know that there's some work that has been done on Canadian fashion, but it wasn't kind of like based in cities and what role fashion plays in the specific identity of a city.
Ah.
And so that's the idea for this book series. So there's Berlin, Vienna, Montreal, and now the newest one is LA Chic. That is out there, edited by my friend and colleague Susan Ingram, and so the idea is to kind of like keep working on these untold stories from these different interesting cities that have gold mines of information that you don't necessarily think of when you look at fashion studies. For sure, that falls through all kinds of cracks within fashion studies. You don't even think of it in terms of cultural history or cultural studies, because when I was going, there's a library in Berlin that is dedicated to all the books written about Berlin. And so the way it's organized, it's thematic. So you have like a bookshelf dedicated to theater, one to art, one to like an art in from all the decades and centuries. There was no bookshelf dedicated to fashion.
Surprise, a glaring omission, isn't it?
So
that empty shelf was your calling.
Got a book on it now.
And the books that have been written about, let's say, Berlin fashion, because the fashion scene there emerged within the last 10 years, and it's quite well funded. They started the Mercedes-Benz has the Berlin Fashion Week.
Like they're doing
That's
fashion
right.
weeks, right?
They have a lot of good funding.
They have two girlfriends who moved to Berlin and have their own fashion labels now.
Ooh, really?
Indie fashion labels, yeah.
Nice.
I would never have guessed, as you say, it's not a traditional quote-unquote fashion city.
Mm-hmm.
I would never have guessed that
But it's such a vibrant artistic city, so of course.
Of course. I mean, it makes perfect sense. Same with Montreal. Like, Montreal has such a
People always talk about LA, style like, I mean, and culture in Montreal, right?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense.
It's cities that have gone through some kind of economic disaster. I feel like Detroit is going to be the next fashion.
Oh, there you go.
Fashion capital to explore, because it's really when the traditional industries move out that artists and young people, really creative people, can move in and afford spaces and afford life, and actually start building something that is experimental. So
so Vancouver's
alternative.
Fucked. Yeah, so it's not happening in Vancouver because none of those things apply.
So Vancouver, you know, give it like 15 years when the bubble will fall out.
Yeah, the bubble just needs to burst. But yeah. I mean, Vancouver is really, really interesting because it has pockets, right?
True.
It's like, and people are holding on.
Yes, there
to
are
those pockets.
White knuckled hanging on to those. Yeah, absolutely.
That's true. Yeah, that is true.
Oh. That's fascinating.
That's how it
So you
all
wrote your
started.
Books and then you started The Scholar. Tell us about that. I was looking at the
network.
The network.
So the network started when I was doing research for the Montreal book, and I realized that there are networks within different organizations or within different cities really connected to certain schools. So there was a network around Ryerson University in Toronto, because they
have like the biggest fashion program stuff, don't they?
They had like one of the only full degree programs at a university for fashion in the country, I think, for a long time.
When we were research.
Yes, that we know of. I have since discovered the Department of Human Ecology. good luck figuring out what that means.
I was going to say, it would not have come up in my Google searches.
You know where it came from? I actually went to the U of A in Edmonton, and I did not know that this program existed, because if you search fashion,
it's not going to come up.
It does not come up, yeah.
And the reason it's called human ecology is because it used to be, back in the day, home economics.
Uh-huh.
Which now is a bit of a dated phrase.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it was like, you know,
so they had to rebrand it.
Yeah.
And they did not put fashion into their branding, so not many people know about it. But
wow,
they do quite amazing work. So last year we had the fashion symposium there, and I got to see the facilities that they have. They have a whole separate building on campus of the University of Alberta. They have exhibition space. They have their own collection. So state-of-the-art.
Oh, wow.
Collections with these rows that move and temperature control and things like that.
Ooh, exciting.
Like the couture archives.
Yes.
Kind of. Oh. Yeah.
Yeah. So because Edmonton is such a strong immigration hub, a lot of people would bring these couture pieces and historical garments from Europe,
all over
the world. And then their children would donate, basically, because what do you do with
old clothes?
And so they have an amazing collection that they're actually now fundraising to have a full-time archivist for, because it's really hard to maintain it and preserve it and all these, you
absolutely
know, like all these resources that you need for it. But then they have labs for students and actual sewing labs and dry and wet labs. And it's like state-of-the-art stuff. And they do a lot of critical thinking part and theory part as well. So they have everything up to a PhD, basically. They have really innovative courses. And I know one of their instructors takes their students to Paris every summer.
Ooh la la.
They have quite the rigorous academic component, the actual making creative component, the historical component with their own collections. The fashion collection.
Who would have known?
I was like at least 2/3 of the way through my degree when I learned.
When you realized that this was a thing.
I think it must have been human ecology by the time I was there. It might have been in the shift in the rebrand, but a friend of mine was in the program and she was telling me about it. I was like, are you
what school are you
going
me?
To mm-hmm. And she told me about this archive and like you go and see these amazing pieces, and yeah, I'm sure it's only grown in the 10 years more than 10 since I was in my degree program. Yeah.
Katie and was very advanced, and she was 5 years old. She was 10 years old when she went to
right. But one of the ways that it came to my attention was in like the whatever newsletter, because it fell under the arts umbrella.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So there's like an alumni newsletter that goes out that you never read and
for sure
delete it from your inbox because you got a better shit to do. But there was this alumni newsletter going out, and it was like highlighting some of the PhD students mm-hmm. in the Faculty of Arts. And one of them was a girl. This was at least 10 years ago now. But one of them was a girl who was doing basically a PhD project on the actual sewing, like the home economic, the sewing at home that women did in the late 1800s or so.
Yeah.
And so her project was, I forget what it was that she actually made, but she recreated the conditions of that era.
Of what that would have
I just
looked
got
like.
Chills when you just pointed at me. I was like, we know the same thing. This is so exciting. I could not believe she like did
I
it
saw,
all by
so there's
candlelight.
Three people who know about this. There's you three. Two and the lady who did it.
Yeah.
So she did it all by candlelight. Display. It's on display in a glass box.
Oh, that's so exciting.
Is her name Caroline something?
I think it was years ago that I've seen
she
it.
She came to the very first symposium that I organized in Montreal. Yeah.
Oh,
and so
amazing.
I slowly started piecing together the connections. And of course, then I went to Edmonton last year and I saw this was where she learned to do all
was it a
this.
Gown that she made? I can't remember. Yeah,
yeah.
But she did it
gown.
All like by candlelight and you
sure.
know straight
with a pedal
chair.
Yeah,
kind
yeah,
of,
yeah.
Like no electricity.
Yeah.
And
oh, wow.
That was part of the research of her project. And it was
that's
like
fantastic.
This is the most I have never seen fashion treated academically that way before. Yeah. And I was like, God damn, this degree that I didn't even know that this
you
is
get,
here.
You get taste every once in a while of the historical aspects of it, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, we have a, the
local man,
Ivan Sayers, who we all love and worship. Who has introduced us to the historical fashion and things, but this sort of academic side of it.
It was a brand new concept
to me. It's a brand new thing.
Yeah. And it was something that I was
looking
for.
And it's so rich and it's interesting and cool and it dabbles in so many parts of human existence, economy and labor and family dynamics and, you know, geography and climate and all these things, right? They all play into it.
Social hierarchies.
Yes, yeah, totally.
Absolutely.
Well, and like world history, war, politics. I mean, look at Berlin as an example. It's a way of looking at culture and the tumult that culture goes through in dire circumstances through that lens. Yeah. And it tells such a different perspective. It tells such a different story.
Yeah.
It was so interesting. I was like, oh, come on. I gotta. Shit. But it's neat because it has it sort of allows you to be interested in fashion and work in quote unquote fashion. You're not working like in the industry per se when you're, at least when you're in school, without having to like learn how to sew, you know, without having to
read Vogue magazine.
Yeah. And you know, do the PR, the journalism sort of side of things where most of the attention goes, or the design side of things where the other half of the attention
goes. Where the work goes and where the less attention goes.
Fashion schools are divided, right? Like where you kind of like
it's a merchandising program or a design program.
You pick your focus and then you have like 2 to 4 years where you really kind of like immerse yourself in your expertise, and then you're prepared for the job market in a sense, right? So but yeah, as far as I know, Ryerson and the human ecology department at U of A are the only ones where you can do graduate school in fashion studies in Canada. There are other departments kind of like scattered where you can piece together a committee of fashion scholars from different departments. So York Ryerson has this like communication and culture program. And so Susan, who's editing the books, she kind of like keeps that as a fashion focused institute, the fashion focus within that institution as well. And there's a few others, but all the other institutions are really fashion schools where traditionally you went to learn how to either sew, but then also have the business aspect of the fashion industry. Mm-hmm. And Ryerson started that way, but then they used to be, I think, a polytechnique, and then they became a university a long time ago now, but they're still kind of like grounded or rooted in the fashion school approach to fashion.
Right, to academics.
When I was working on the Montreal book and I started talking to different fashion scholars in Montreal and in Toronto, and basically saying, if I organize a symposium, I was in Toronto and I was asking the Toronto people who were around York and around Ryerson, would you come to Montreal? And everyone said, yes, of course.
It was a Montreal.
Just any reason to come to Montreal. And same with Montreal people. I said, would you go to Toronto if there was, you know, a kind of like some kind of a network, some kind of a community? And Toronto at the time actually did have a network that was grounded at Ryerson. But it wasn't, no one was part of it outside of basically.
Oh, it was very insular.
Right. It was so much of a bubble. So,
they're talking to each other, but nobody else.
Exactly. Mm. And it was really hard.
And then you come in and burst that bubble.
It was really hard doing this kind of research where you're trying to understand how Canadian fashion, what Canadian fashion
what that
even
big picture
is,
looks like, right?
Yeah. Has anyone already done this work? Because as an academic, the thing you start with when you start your research is a literature review. You have to understand
what's already been done.
You have to scan the field. You have to lay out kind of like your pieces of the puzzle and understand how to approach this data, this knowledge. And when I was doing that, it was really hard to do because I couldn't even access the information. And so
wow.
I basically said there must be an easier way to find out who has written books about Canadian fashion and who hasn't.
Right.
And who's working on this stuff already so that I'm not just running in circles here.
Yeah.
And very gradually, I organized the first symposium in Montreal at the McCord Museum, which is a history museum. It's a history of the city museum. And they have a really large fashion collection that tells the story of the city through clothes, which is exactly what Berlin wanted.
Right.
Montreal has that.
Uh-huh.
And so I started seeing connections because I already had the Berlin experience. I had the Vienna experience. So I knew what I was looking for. I kind of knew what questions to ask and kind of like where to look for information. And the McCord Museum, the curator, the fashion curator there, her mandate aligned with mine because she also wanted to know who's working on what and build these connections and networks and talk to these people who are working on.
Yeah, this isn't a unique experience or a unique mm-hmm. field to a specific location, right? It's all over yeah. the place.
And yeah, nor exactly. is it new.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
This isn't a 21st century invention. Like,
yeah. It, like we were talking upstairs, we were saying like it's strange that, you know, there's only a few cities in Canada that are like, you know, fashion cities again, quote unquote, and they weren't talking to each other. Like, how can that be? Well, let's bridge mm-hmm. that gap.
Yeah, let's make that happen.
Essentially,
and there you go.
Yes. Was. Yeah.
And I mean, we should also say Canada is the third largest country in the world. So yeah. it's geographically really, really big. So building community is a really... It's a completely different kind of thing when you do it.
You can't
it.
Just take the train to the next city exactly. and, you know, meet somebody yeah. for the exactly. afternoon and come home for dinner.
Exactly.
You
know? So yeah. it's different. There's a reason why it's so insular and why the East Coast and the West Coast don't talk to each other and the middle is just like...
Just forgotten.
Yeah. Overlooked.
Yeah, so the dude from Manitoba is sitting right
own,
there.
It's,
yeah.
its own...
It's its own situation
own
entirely.
Situation.
Yeah.
By the way...
Who knows what's going on there?
The next fashion symposium is going to be a Ryerson in Toronto and the one after that I would like to have in Winnipeg.
Oh my gosh.
Well, you keep Evan's number
both.
Then.
Yes. Yeah. 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 Both. Yeah. I have lots to say, even though I've just been sitting here taking in all this... All of this brilliance for the whole, I don't know,
that's 20
half
minutes,
hour.
Half an hour. Yeah. I know, we didn't even catch up with each other. We're just dive right in, like, tell
this
me all
too
of your stories.
Yeah, exactly.
This is too interesting.
Give a shit. I'm busy. I say that every week.
Literally, my thing this week was I went to Costco and IKEA. So
you're not missing out.
I'm missing out on a bunch of, like,
yeah. I think, like, it was so great for me to come from Manitoba and come from a very rural upbringing. And come to Vancouver and go to fashion school and meet people like Abby and Katie and all of our fashion fam and start having these dialogues about fashion that I've just kind of had in my head my whole life and just like...
Sure, and you can't flesh them out.
Yeah.
And you can't, you know, like...
You know, because like growing up, there was no books about fashion. We didn't have fashion magazines in our library, but there were things about historical fashion. And then it was always bringing things... To it's like, oh, this happened this way because of this political thing, and then these textiles were brought during this expedition, and like fashion to me has always been something that speaks to the time in which it's created,
grounded. But also very and Eurocentric,
exactly.
very Western.
Yes. Obviously, so, I'm talking about
grounded in colonial history, but grounded in immigrant history, right? As
mm-hmm.
well,
mm-hmm.
So that it's brought into Canada by.
Exactly.
Peoples, but then there's also this whole indigenous fashion kind of like history that is only now getting kind of like brought up and researched.
And exactly. And I think we'd be remiss, especially with me here and you yourself, without talking about Riley Kutrin and the work that he's done and about indigenous fashion and
mm-hmm.
really making it so clear and so concise in his work about the role of fashion in colonialism and how
mm-hmm. How inextricably they are
and
linked.
How stripping the visual identity of an indigenous person in residential schools and making them take on a Western visual identity was crucial to the assimilation project.
And, like,
and the eradication.
And the eradication of
these
of cultural
of
practices.
Cultures. Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. see, like, you, it in just that one statement, you can see how powerful something like fashion can be in
absolutely
the most and you can empowering ways and you can apply that
to the whole planet. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah. It's happened. Well, Berlin was another example.
Exactly.
You know,
yeah. Yeah.
It brings together politics, identity, society, labor practices, gender, gendered labor, right? Like, so in such concrete material ways, right? You really can trace, you have evidence, which is very, very traceable, right? Like, and I think the work that museums and kind of like exhibitions do by making it accessible to see these traces of these types of discourses and histories and these kinds of like political conflicts that when you write about or when you write a history of a place or of a culture, you edit it, right? And when you're faced with kind of like the materiality of clothing and artifacts, and you come across very specific contradictions. And so making that visible and pointing, you know, like pointing a light on it and basically saying, well, this is fur or this is, you know, like colonial fashion and this is indigenous fashion, and even having to find the language to talk about these artifacts becomes a very interesting process of kind of like dealing with politics, of dealing with history. And I mean, it's such a loaded history, right, within Canadian history. Like, what can you even have a concept of Canadian fashion? What does that even mean?
What does that look like? Yeah.
Yeah, to talk about the history of Canadian fashion is to talk of colonialism. They will never...
Yeah, they're not...
They're, like, yeah. They're
it's impossible to separate the two of them.
Yeah.
Because, like, by and large, you like, when you can think about American fashion, and America has done such a good job about creating an instant visual image. When you think American fashion, you think white t-shirt, blue jeans.
Sure. Think American flag.
American flag, everything.
Cowboy hat.
Yeah.
I was just reading Al Decor about Ralph Lauren, and there was a lot of that going on.
You think Ralph Lauren, you know, you think of names.
Tommy Hilfiger.
Yeah. And when you think Canadian fashion, if you could say that to anyone anywhere in the planet who has never been to Canada before, they wouldn't be able to tell you.
The only thing they would tell you is the Red Surge from the RCMP. Yeah,
they'd probably say a huge tie to the colonial history.
But I don't know if necessarily, if you would say, quote, fashion, you wouldn't go to, my mind, a police uniform.
No, but in terms of the global image of Canadian fashion, that would be the
maybe the point the blanket. The
first
point
example.
HBC again.
Furs.
Huge colonial connotations.
Yeah.
And
fur industry,
the fur trade,
beaver hats.
Country
you might think of a Croix de Bois, one of the.
Yeah, you might, you'd have to know the history.
You'd have to have some sort of knowledge of the history.
And I think, you know, like being reduced to stereotypes happens because the reclaiming of kind of like self narratives from indigenous point of views, from kind of like settler but also immigrant point of views, that needs to kind of like that's still growing, that's still in its infancy, right? And so because there's not a lot to put out in the world that says this is what we think Canadian fashion is from all of these different perspectives, so please stop stereotyping.
Yeah, there's no other information.
Yeah, until that happens.
So that you're just left with the stereotypes, right? Like, because there's nothing else.
Yeah, until it happens on a mainstream level, it will be Mountie uniforms, right? Like, it's like, even though that's so misrepresentative of...
Completely.
But I think in many ways, Canada's kind of leaned into the stereotype of the, like, dopey RCMP officer because it absolves Canada of a lot of the horrors that were done for it to become a country. You know, like if the rest of the world looks at Canada as like the kinder little brother to the US, it's easier from a public relations standpoint or like a global image standpoint. It's easier to be seen as docile and weaker than to
helpful and polite and
friendly, you know, friendly Canadian.
Yeah. We're funny and we're polite.
Yes.
You know, and like,
and we haven't committed gross atrocities that are of equal level to many other people's.
Well, that's not a brand that sells, right? Like Mountie uniforms can be as a symbol or a souvenir or a brand that, you know, like it's like that presents a certain narrative and a certain symbolism and imagery, but genocide against indigenous people doesn't.
Yes. I would argue too that I think historically the image of the Mountie and the Red Surge isn't dopey. I think it was an image of strength that just completely bypassed this genocidal history. Okay. I think it was
it's the pioneer survival narrative.
Yes, yeah. It's the story of winning the West.
It was so hard and it was so cold, but we survived.
But we survived.
And we built all this stuff.
Exactly. And it's, you know,
there
it's
was
a hard
nothing
land.
Here before, and we built it up.
Exactly. That's the narrative.
Everyone's crying.
But that's what I would, I mean,
there's Dudley Do-Right, and then Dudley,
That's who I think of. I think of Dudley Do-Right.
But Dudley Do-Right was a reaction of that. Dudley Do-Right was a reactionary character based on this this image of this strong...
Yeah, that pioneer spirit.
Pioneer spirit who's going to come in and save the day, you know, when some guy's trying to steal your gold, you know, all that kind of stuff. Like, literally, that's... Yeah. You know, I took a few classes.
You go to your land that the government allotted you, that you now own for no money, because you showed up
and you raised it
first.
And the Mounties will protect,
protect your stake down. And
I took a really, really interesting class in university on post-colonial Canadian literature, and we talked quite a bit about that. And I don't know if I mentioned this.
There's no such thing as post-colonial anything.
It's still happening.
It's still happening.
Continue.
In literary circles.
Yeah. That came up a lot.
That came up. In fact.
Same with post-feminism.
It doesn't exist.
It's not a thing either. Post-racism, post-feminism, post-colonialism. It's all.
We're not post-black.
There's so many jokes within indigenous communities. It's like we're post-colonialism, apparently.
But also still...
But we're still very much
back in
neo-colonialism is more.
There's so many posts that were actually built the fence out of them to keep you up. But we talked about this image of this Mountie and being this image of that's what Canada is selling to the world, is this image of strength and everything
and resilience and ingenuity
exactly. And I grew up in
you grew up in Alberta,
town,
right?
Where you know, Canada Day every year we'd have the Mounties out in Red Surge. Every RCMP officer has them. They come out and the kids dress up and they have their little things
and little hats on,
and I, you know, mentioned in class during this discussion, I was like, as cool as this image is that we project to the world, like if we were having a house party and we're getting super loud and rowdy and you call the cops, they're not showing up in the Red Surge. This is a PR stunt, you know, and it's strong and it works, which is why the Dudley Do-Right thing is such a hilarious character, is because it was the opposite of what they were trying to sell. Mm-hmm. And it's what now the world sees of Canada, for better or worse. In a lot of ways.
I lost my thought.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But can I bring us back to Winnipeg?
Yes.
I think I really want to go to Winnipeg. So discovering kind of like the amazing stuff that they have in Edmonton was quite great. And it's harder to bring people, like especially people from the East Coast. Like it's easier to ask people to come to Montreal or Toronto or even Vancouver, but it's harder to ask people to go anywhere else in Canada for whatever reason.
But further biases exist. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think it is important because you find out the amount of creativity that happens in a city like, especially a city like Winnipeg that has culture that, you know, like it's like that has so many different cultural and creative circles that overlap and that work together and that create new cultures, is so important. And so I think it's like, even though this is something that I do as a volunteer on my weekends and this is like not a job for me, but I think it's important because connecting to building this community and connecting to the places that people do not think of as fashion spaces is kind of what this whole network is for. So I'm really excited. Like I'll be in touch with you.
You've made a new friend today.
And in conjunction with bringing people to those places and discovering those stories, you can unearth the things that have kind of gone unseen for so long.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, like my aunt used to work in garment production in Winnipeg. She started in like the late 60s, I think, when she joined the labor force, and ended in the early 90s. And then that's when she started working from home and was like a home sewer and whatever. But she has some hell of a story. Like, she has so many stories of working in the labor force. She worked, she started as a stitcher and made her way all the way up to quality control. That was like her last, she was like the head of quality control for Nygaard when she left. Yeah.
Working her way up.
Yeah, and I'm sure she's a wealth of knowledge.
I was going to say the stuff that lady has seen and done. And
next time she's in town, let's get her in here.
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, she loves to travel. She she usually leaves Vancouver when she goes on her Alaskan cruises.
Oh, correct. Yes.
Oh, yeah. She can stop over.
Yeah, she's earned her Alaskan cruises.
I bet,
for sure.
Oh, boy. I'll have to invite her to this.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah, She'd love it so much.
Give her a big name tag.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
About
exactly.
For sure.
One thing I had mentioned, or I had thought of before, but the time it didn't line up to say it out loud, is when we were talking about the museums and the sort of sharing of this knowledge. And like, for example, I did not know of the history, that history in Berlin was that deep and ran that rich. Mm-hmm. So one thing that I think is really interesting that we were talking a little bit about before is that the nature of fashion as a medium for history is quite... Because fashion and clothes are so intimate, it's such an...
And subjective. And
subjective.
And personal. And,
It's one of the only ways that you can see an artifact and connect with it in a way... Like, you could see... go to the Museum of Anthropology and see a beautiful totem pole that blows your mind, and it's incredible.
Mm-hmm. But an ancient tool or something.
Mm-hmm. But if you go in and you see, a beautiful...
An axe.
Yeah, right.
I'm like, I personally can't connect with the 2,000-year-old axe.
No,
it's beautiful and it's significant.
Or utensils,
but you can't imagine, seeing one of those. They have these beautiful capes and coats, and there's a proper word that I'm misremembering of what the Coast Salish coats and blankets are called. But you can see a garment and imagine what it is like to wear it, what it would be like to make it in a way that like a
design
totem pole
it.
Or a hammer or a tool of some
mm-hmm.
kind, you don't get that same kind of connection. Mm-hmm. And I think that's such a unique and such a cool way to learn history and to learn culture
mm-hmm.
because everyone knows what it's like to put a coat on.
Yeah.
Everyone knows what it's like to have a pair of pants that's one of my favorite ways to learn about places and people mm-hmm. is like, what are they wearing? And you can see how it shifts throughout history. It's so fascinating.
I think it's because all artifacts tell stories. All historical artifacts tell stories. That's why museums collect stuff, right? Other than that would not, why you have craft museums, for example, right? So, but I think clothing also has this element of embodiment and bodies that lived in it. And
there's a real warm-blooded person.
Exactly.
Right?
And so it has a personal history,
a human history, an embodied
history, but then also a family history, right? Like it was produced in a human context. So it was worn for a particular event or function, or it was made with kind of like knowledge that was passed down through generations, mm-hmm. mostly of female labor traditionally, right? But that was then kind of like kept within families as this like knowledge capital, right? So it has all these kinds of intricate connections to humanity in that sense, right? And so deconstructing that and kind of like uncovering that is real detective work. And
mm-hmm. yeah. and recontextualizing it mm-hmm. too in the bigger picture.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like you say, when people donate these old clothes that have been in their family. And like we've seen this Ivan Sayers, who one day we'd get on this podcast. So old, but mm-hmm. then get no one knows who he is, but he's the best.
I know him.
Yes.
He's amazing. He came to the Vancouver Symposium.
Oh, I went to his house once. Mm-hmm. Oh my God.
Yes.
I've still never been.
Oh God. Yeah. Anyway, but yes. Ivan Sayers, he's a historian that uses fashion to tell history, mm-hmm. and he can say this dress was bought by this woman. This is her name. She bought it when she was in Shanghai in 1932. It was at this factory. Yeah. And they know, you know, she was there for this reason. And her husband was doing this. And because in the bigger picture, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, it gets macro and it gets micro. And it gets, you know, it's.
Yeah. The fashion collectors.
It can be really traceable. Like, it's so, like, you don't know who used that axe. But you know who wore that dress.
Exactly.
Yeah,
both Ivan and Klaus Janke. So they work together. Klaus collects Berlin and Viennese fashion artifacts. So again, brought to Canada through immigration. And basically, he traces them just like Ivan. Ivan collects more British, I think, artifacts, but also global stuff.
Usually British people went to China.
They covered a lot of ground, those friends.
The Commonwealth. And so... And they both have this approach to collecting that is history based and kind of like they have the actual garment. Then they will have photographs of the people who have worn it, maybe the original people or where it appeared. So I've been to Klaus's house. I haven't been to Ivan's house. Mm-hmm. So Klaus liked to, when Berliner Schick came out, Klaus found me. And so I've seen the collections that he has.
That's awesome.
And so he would show me the original magazine from the 1950s of one of the West Berlin designers who made a dress. That dress somehow ends up in Vancouver.
Yeah.
And then
fascinating. Bad story, hey?
The family puts it either up for sale on eBay or donates it to Goodwill. He goes finds it at Goodwill.
He trolls through, you know?
Yeah. Exactly.
Sally Ann comes across it.
And then the family also gives it, he starts doing research. The family gives him photographs of when the dress was originally worn, when other people in the family have worn it. So he pieces together these stories, these family stories based on the garment's history and its creation. And of course, with a place like Germany, there's that whole dark part of the history. So then the question is, when was it made? Was it made during the Holocaust? And so are there traces to the Holocaust? Were the buttons made in a concentration camp? Were the zippers maybe produced under slave labor conditions and so on and so forth.
Repurposed from who knows what.
Exactly. Yeah. Is this like there? He has these different labels that actually say if it's any time between the 30s and the 40s, the labels themselves say something like Aryanized production.
Oh, gosh.
So Aryan production. Gosh. So to distinguish it.
From the other.
From the, the other.
Much less desirable.
So fascinating stuff. And it's amazing that you have these two amazing collectors in Vancouver and they educate people. They put on
and nobody knows, and the government doesn't give a shit.
Yeah, I know. And they're also fighting to build a museum, right? Like it's like, and so there's all these efforts to basically make this history accessible, and all these people who are dedicating their lives to collect, to tell the stories, to gather the information, to do this like very detailed and informed research, to have kind of like the wider, like you said, the wider understanding of it, and then the zoom in and kind of like look at the actual materiality of it, and yet there is no funding for any of this because it falls through the cracks, like we were talking earlier. It's not considered art, so we don't get art funding.
It's not considered a trade, so you don't get kind of any of that.
No, the industry
merchandising,
doesn't care
not merchandising,
about this.
Manufacturing, any of that kind of stuff.
No one gives money to anybody to start a museum of anything.
Yeah.
It makes me think if fashion was traditionally a man's trade, I'm sure it would be so much easier to get funding to accumulate and disseminate the history.
And validate.
The history of humanity
celebrate male labor.
Exactly.
Weird.
Like most art galleries in the world
full of male artists.
Yeah. You know, if we need to see another Monet, Matisse fucking exhibit.
Yeah.
Even ancient Greeks. Yeah. I mean, those are all men.
That's how most museums fund their other exhibitions.
Is through this huge exhibit.
You have to put on display the money makers, which is unfortunately Monet or something with gold.
Yeah.
Anything Egyptian, anything yeah. with gold in it.
Right.
Right? Like
anything
treasure,
fancy and shiny.
Anything stolen.
Yeah. Yeah. So that, yeah, will yeah, make, yeah. that will make millions. And then you can put on smaller and usually like site alternative yeah. exhibitions like fashion. Yeah, that's how they fund there. But again, because there's a limited amount of grants that, that either museums can apply for or any organizations and institutions can apply for. And then you have to fundraise. And of course, the funding is also, fundraising is also a very conservative practice mm-hmm. because people get to tell you how that money gets used.
And all the people who have the money are of a certain demographic yeah. and exactly. a certain age group yes. and a certain
so
political leaning a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And, uh-huh.
yeah. Yeah.
They want to see water lilies 18 different
exactly.
ways.
Yes. So it's all, politics money distribution.
Damn it.
I'm certain all the rich white conservative folk who are
listening to the show.
No. who are donating.
So what are you doing here? How did you end up here?
How did you make it an hour into
oh,
this?
Oh boy,
you're in the wrong place. Yeah. I mean, stay, but you're welcome.
Send us a check.
We would love to
listen
have you.
Up.
take notes.
I'm sure they exactly. They'd much rather see the French masters than see
over and
native
over.
Fashion
yeah.
now.
Yeah,
which
yeah,
was
over
like
and over. That's
a
right.
A groundbreaking yeah. exhibition that was done at the Museum of the American Indian in New York, I think 2 years ago. And I think they're trying to do native fashion now too, which is going to be a continuation of that work.
Fantastic. So, there you go. Yeah.
Baby steps.
Exactly.
Baby steps.
And you're on the front line, my friend.
Oh, I fucking hope so. I hope so.
Damn it.
Avant-garde. Hey man, you were in Vogue magazine, okay? Speaking of baby steps and speaking of Vogue, the first Indigenous woman was on a
yes!
Vogue magazine.
I saw. She's so excited. Yeah. She looks amazing. Yes. It's so exciting.
Vogue
her story is so
mm-hmm.
interesting. Mm-hmm.
I mean, as great as that is, it's about 25 years
back
too late.
In time.
Yes.
Yeah.
But
that's very exciting.
Very exciting.
Yes.
Yeah.
I just saw that today.
I think when you posted it, maybe. Yeah.
A big step for Indigenous women, a tiny, tiny, very belated step for Vogue.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, a long overdue embarrassing
Vogue's never been
step.
One to be at the forefront of social
progressive.
Movement.
Yes.
Progressive. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But why, right? Like, it's exactly. like if conservative practices or ideology is about maintaining the status quo,
that's
anything,
not fashion.
Anything that disrupts it yeah. is a risk. And mm-hmm. just like with Hollywood blockbusters, why take risks if you can have the same thing over and over again, just slightly
and make money,
mm-hmm. slightly different that
or not even
know,
not even
yeah,
slightly
carbon copy.
Yeah. Look at all those superhero Marvel franchises they make.
By the way, saw Captain Marvel.
Yes,
fucking amazing.
Is it good?
Yes.
It's so good. Okay, I got to see it.
It's now the highest grossing
yes.
Marvel
movie of all time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Eat
are the in
shit.
The opening weekend? I think.
Yeah. Nerds.
Really of all time.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's making
it past Black Panther.
Yeah. It did
really because Black Panther broke through a whole bunch of shit, and then now it's. It's amazing. She's
and
amazing. It's great. It's beautiful. It's
unlike Wonder Woman, she does not have a man that she's obsessed with.
It's not a love story.
Yeah. Does it pass the Bechdel test?
Yeah.
Get out.
Really? Yeah. Because she has her girlfriend.
Yes.
And they talk
yes.
about their own shit.
Yes.
And their relationship with each other and their history and yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
There's also a lot of dudes.
There's always going to be
but
dudes.
But they're, you know.
You can't have a superhero movie without a dude floating around.
Dudes. Jude Law is pretty great.
We should say anyway. The woman's name, who is actually on the cover of Vogue. She was the...
Yelitsa
Aparicio.
Yeah.
I'm sure I'm saying that wrong. Apologies to all of our Latin friends. But she was in Roma. She was the lead actress in Roma, nominated.
I feel very strongly about that movie.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I still haven't seen it. I haven't seen it either.
Maybe I'll watch it this weekend.
How do you feel about it?
It's an Indigenous woman with no autonomy, and her story doesn't revolve around her. It revolves around the...
other people around
the family
her.
She works
the
for.
The rich, yeah. white passing family that
which
she works for.
Which is the director's personal story,
yeah.
right? So, yeah.
I mean, it was his perspective,
mm-hmm.
you know?
At least he's being authentic
he really
that way.
He didn't know anything about the Indigenous woman who took care of him his entire life.
Because he didn't care to. He didn't need to.
Yeah, it is definitely from
his point
of view.
It wasn't important to know her story.
Yeah, it was interesting because a lot of people who are like Latinx descent loved the movie because it propped up a dark-skinned Mexican woman, Indigenous woman, but then Indigenous people were just like,
the fuck, dude?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, like there's literally scenes of her cleaning up dog shit and like,
mm-hmm.
you know, just getting and verbally abused by her
and
bosses.
And being at the mercy of every other character, really.
Yeah.
In every scene and every conversation. Yeah, same thing. It's like great in terms of representation, but content,
still work to be done.
It still falls into old stereotypes of
whose point of view who's telling exactly.
The story. Get the indigenous woman to do the directing and the writing.
As you say, get her behind the camera.
There's some great pictures coming out from indigenous filmmakers in the next, I don't know, 2 years. I got the skinny because my brother's a filmmaker and
he's got his ear to the ground.
He's got his ear to the ground. No. He's always whispering to me and sending me links and stuff.
Oh, that's some great pictures. Good to know. You will help keep the rest of us.
Oh, it'll be. I'm sure it'll be my obsession.
Yes,
you in will. The next couple of
just try to get him to not talk about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, well, we've taken
so
a little
the work
bit
is
of
being
a,
done.
We've taken a little bit of a turn, and we're about an hour in, so I think it's a good time to take a break.
Oh,
I know. We'll just have to have. Well, mind you, maybe we can't have Kat back because you're moving away. Maybe next time you're in town.
Yeah, I'll come and visit.
Well, we'll have to use this connection, this network that you
absolutely
built to get him in here.
Yeah.
But I also wanted to say that the network so far consisted of mostly scholars, curators, and students, definitely. I tried to make it as inclusive as possible, but I was so happy to find you guys because you work in the industry. You understand the connections between kind of like the exhibition side, the academic side, and the industry side. So, I hope we can keep collaborating.
We talked about that upstairs a little bit as well, and how it was an interesting perspective to hear from you that that those two sides don't talk that often, which is once you leave academia.
Some kind of intimidation on both sides because academics like to be in their bubble and don't like to step outside, even if they're community-minded, they still feel intimidated to go to fashion weeks to talk to designers and do that kind of outreach, I guess, and vice versa. So,
and unfortunately, there's not a lot of events outside of fashion shows that are built around that kind of thing.
So that are opportunities for that sort of...
Yeah, and we've talked about fashion shows before and how they are not great most of the time, regardless of what's actually being shown on the runways. Mm-hmm. In terms of it as a fashion event, they're not great. You're not getting the people necessarily that you want to be having those conversations with at a fashion show because, A, they are intimidating. They can be extremely exclusive and quite snooty and ego boost and hard to get through.
And
there's
not a lot of stand around talking to each other.
No.
You know, there's fashion shows where you sit and watch, or you get your picture taken, or you have these cheesy cocktail parties where no one's talking about anything of consequence, and it's so shallow and vapid and useless.
And there's just a wall with the banner with all the sponsors in the back, and you get your picture taken, and then that's the evening.
The networking or the collaboration that happens is very kind of like industry connection based to kind of get an into something. Whereas I think in the academic world, the collaborative stuff is more like, oh, okay, so we're both working on the same kind of research. So, you know, like it's like, should we maybe start a journal together? Or so it's very different
fashion designers
type
do
of
that.
Collaborations.
It's like, I'm not letting you know where I got my fabric.
Right.
I'm not letting you know who sews for me too. Right.
There's that too. There's that kind of like closed off protectiveness of research or of expertise. But I'm trying to break these walls a little bit. And when we had the fashion symposium in Vancouver in 2015, it was at the Museum of Vancouver, and they had asked, this is when I was collaborating with Ivan, had asked for some kind of fashion show after the symposium. So the symposium is usually a couple of panels.
We went to that show, me and you.
Mm-hmm.
We did. We went to the museum. No, we didn't go to the symposium, but we saw the exhibit.
You came to the show. Okay.
And we dressed up in some clothes and took some silly pictures.
Amazing. Yeah. Okay, so we've kind of met before.
There's some overlap.
Your circles have overlapped.
We've been
really
in the same space before.
Different times.
So, the museum wanted a show after the symposium to bring people who wouldn't normally come to the museum into the museum space and kind of like mix it up a little bit and bring maybe younger people.
I think it was the first time I'd been to that museum.
Well, it worked.
There
then.
You go.
And so, Ivan and I worked together on this exhibit where I wanted to meet young, cutting-edge designers who were graduating from fashion schools back in 2015. And I'm sorry, I didn't know
it. You live and you learn.
And so I went to Vancouver Fashion Week for the first time. And basically, there's a whole category of young and up-and-coming kind of like graduates, essentially. And I approached them. And whoever said yes, I then asked, basically, I asked them to pick one design from their graduation collection. And then I sent the pictures that they sent me to Ivan. And I asked Ivan to go through his collection and pick something that speaks,
that fits
somehow together in conversation, that, that can create a conversation with this new cutting edge piece that is innovating fashion. And he managed to find a piece for, I think there were over 10 pieces. It's been a while.
Oh, that doesn't shock me at all.
It was, it was 10 completely different designs. And he found something that was in direct conversation historically,
aesthetically,
fabric wise, or
technique,
something like that. And so that was, that was the show.
What a brilliant concept for a show.
It was so much fun to work on that.
I bet he loved it. I bet you,
it was really fun. And I think we need to have more of these. And yeah, after Winnipeg, we'll bring it back to Vancouver, and we definitely should work
together
it
again
and do something like that.
That'd be fantastic.
It'd
be
great to live.
Yes. Oh my gosh, that'd be the best. It would be great too, like you said, like to open up the conversation, as you say, not just between, you know, the museum side of things and the history side of things with the academic and the student side of things, but like we are in now, we're in the industry and the expertise that we've got. I wouldn't say we're experts, but the experience and the expertise that we've learned since moving or since graduating from fashion school is above and beyond what we learned while we were actually in school, of course. So getting those connections to bridge maybe even all three of those.
Exactly.
This is really exciting.
I mean, is there a downside? I don't think so.
No. There'll be like a Fashion Hags panel at the symposium.
Oh,
and
great.
Then we'll put a show together.
Can we interview Ivan?
You can interview.
How many dates do we have? Because we'll interview with Ivan.
Oh, we'll have to do a two-part special.
Guys, volume one.
We'll take a little more planning, but we'll make it happen.
We'll have to see if that we can accommodate his schedule.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Oh, he's a busy man.
Yeah, so the next one, as I mentioned, is going to be in Toronto at Ryerson University. Is graciously hosting us on September 21st. It's always on the symposium is always on a Saturday so that people can travel. And hopefully Winnipeg after that, and then hopefully Vancouver after that.
Good times! Oh, that's so exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's leave it there on that note. Let's put a pin in it, as you say, and take a quick break, and then we'll come back to Obsess.
Yeah. And we're back from the longest break ever. We've just been sitting here for over half an hour, not recording.
Solving all the problems?
All the problems.
Off the record.
Off the record.
Yeah, fashion hug.
Off the record is fun.
You feel so naughty when you're in front of the microphones, but they're not on.
We're not recording, right?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I think we said that two or three times in the process of this break.
Oh, but the whole point of this whole endeavor is that we record it. Let's get back to that part.
Let's get to the real fun part.
And we can get to some obsessions.
Yes.
I know Kat came with one. Do you want to start or do you want to wait?
Oh, I get to start?
Okay. You don't have to.
I'll start. Okay. My obsession today and yesterday and for a while now is Michelle Obama.
Oh, so that's what brought you to Vancouver, isn't it?
It brought me to Vancouver. She gave a really inspiring talk to a stadium, a sold out stadium.
You get the hockey arena.
Like it was the Rogers Arena, sold out event. She was
and Robin Roberts was the moderator.
She's a big deal too.
Yeah, it was
exciting.
Great. Two really amazing women of color, both with a great presence. They the it was quite the production. There's a video that she starts with that basically tells, is a summary of the book, her book Becoming. So this is her book tour, essentially, except that it's in an arena.
Can you imagine? Oh my God.
So they start with this really cool playlist to get everyone in the mood. And then they show the video with photos of her as a little girl, and then kind of like through her career and then into the White House years. And then first they had four women, I believe, mostly queer or indigenous and women of color on stage from Vancouver. And basically they asked them a question, how are you, in what ways are you becoming, which is the title of the book. Oh, and wow. So they each shared a very personal local Vancouver story, an immigrant story, a queer story. It was a diversity of different women responding. And then Robin Roberts came on stage. And then when Michelle Obama entered, the whole arena stood up.
Oh.
And I was sitting really, really high up because that's the only tickets we could get. But seeing the stage and the whole arena from that bird's eye perspective was so emotional, because you see the power that she has over a whole arena, where everyone stood up and cheered and clapped just as she walked out onto the stage. And then they sat down and had a conversation, and she kind of embellished the stories from her book. So if you guys haven't read the book, I really recommend it, because she made it really, really personal. And basically the gist, her message to the world, to us, to Vancouverites, but also everywhere else, because they're touring North America, and I think they're going to Europe next, is basically that everyone's story is valuable and oh so important. And so that the book is not so much really, it's her story and it's her life story, but it's really just to allow people to see the ups and downs of everyone's life, and to be able to feel empowered to tell their own stories. And that was, so yeah, they kind of like started on a high note and finished on a high note. And it was basically her way of sending all of us out into our daily lives and feeling like we matter, feeling like we have something to say and that we should be saying it.
Basically. Oh, she's so amazing.
Oh, that's so exciting.
Queen.
That was fun.
Yas.
Yas, queen.
That's definitely on my
You're reading this?
Reading this. Actually, mm-hmm. I just started a book. I didn't start it. A group of girlfriends and myself have started a book club. And we want to lean away from the white dude.
Yeah, there you go.
Author.
Put Michelle Obama on top of that list.
So I just wrote it and I was like, book club, like, start this.
Yep.
Write myself a note. This will be the next one on the list for sure.
It's so much fun. I listened to the audiobook that she reads herself.
Oh.
So it's really, really
Katie
cool
loves a good audiobook.
Oh my God,
cool to hear it in her voice.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. What an amazing experience.
It was.
That will probably affect you the rest of your life.
It was quite inspirational, yeah.
Oh.
Empowering, right? Like coming from such a queen, such a woman who has so much to offer the world right now.
She's
right?
done so much and mm-hmm. can still offer. So much.
And comes from such a place of joy and mm-hmm. inclusion.
Yeah, and positivity and, you know.
Yeah, inspirational joy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oof, good one.
Fantastic.
Abby, what do you got?
I am obsessed with this new Instagram account. Well, it's not a new Instagram account. It's new to me. My friend Tina. Hi, Tina. She told me about this lady. Her name's Jenna Lee. She lives in Austin, Texas. And she is a former news anchor and journalist. And she has started her own news outlet called Smart Her News. So smart, you say it quickly, smarter news, but it's Smart Her, as in lady, news. And as a person, she is charming and funny and watchable and interesting. But she does these every single weekday. She doesn't do them on the weekends, I don't think. But on the weekdays, she does these Instagram live videos that are 10 minutes long. She calls them... Oh, she's called Coffee Time or Coffee News or forget what it's called now. And every day she gives you 10 minutes of news and what you need to be paying attention to.
Ooh.
And it's just her in her kitchen holding a coffee cup and holding her phone She's yelling at her kids, fighting over pancakes or whatever. Yeah, get yourself a glass of water or whatever. No, you can't wear those pants, whatever. So I identify with her on that level. And she just tells you, oh, this has been happening here. It's very U.S. centric because she's American. And she lives in the States, but she's also very good at looking internationally and how the stuff that's happening in the States is affecting people outside of it and, you know, and stuff that's happening outside of the States entirely. And it's just, she said she wanted to create a way for people, a new way for people to get their news because that is changing so much. Like the way I really get my news is I watch TV. That's how I don't like reading about it. I don't get newspapers. Like I go to BBC.com sometimes or CBC, but it's not the same. And it's so chopped up sometimes and you just get the little 2-minute story about something and it's not the same as listening to a human voice tell you, mm-hmm. right? So I find I've been trying to figure out a way to get my news. So trying to find a way to make it accessible to me on a regular, consistent basis. Like I try to watch the 5:30 news every night. It's the international news. It's the national global one that I like to watch. It's not the local one, which is like car accidents and snowstorms or whatever. Yeah, people got lost in the mountain again.
You guys, there was traffic. Can you believe it?
That bridge.
We had a lot of snow. Up. That's a lot of snow news.
Yeah, there was a lot there this was year. A lot. So I try to watch the 5:30 news, which is the international stories, right? So I try to do that and try to, that's the, like, even, except it's during dinner time. So my kids are like, why are we watching this? I just need 10 minutes to watch the headlines. Like, I don't even care about the next 20 minutes of the show. Just give me the headlines.
Mommy needs to stay globally informed.
I need to figure out what's going on in the world. What's happening in North Korea? What's happening in New Zealand? What's going on? So this lady, Jenna Lee, has made this accessible, interesting, topical, consistent. And she's also an incredible journalist. She's, you know, she's not, it's not opinion. It's not, she looks to actual sources and questions things and tells you to go look to things like, go check this out. And if you don't like that, then look over here and look what this other journalist is doing and see what, you know, see if that's something you're interested in. It's just, I've been watching for maybe the last couple weeks now and I try to do it every day. And so they're Instagram live too. So they're up for about 24 hours. So you can always, if I don't catch them in the, when she airs them or whatever.
Within 24 hours.
I can still catch mm-hmm. them while I'm laying in bed or I can catch mm-hmm. yesterday's when I'm waking up in the morning or something. So it's been great and I can't recommend it enough.
That reminds me a lot of this other Instagram that I have fallen in love with called Jessica Yellen.
And ooh, I don't know.
It's a similar vein. She was a journalist for years and years, I think with the Washington Post, but I could be wrong. And
how do you spell her last name?
Sorry. Yellen, like Yellin.
Okay, well, there you go.
And that's what her handle is. And she does this whole thing of news, not noise. So if you hashtag search news, not
there
noise,
you go.
That's she'll what break it down kind of and be like, this is the thing that you're going to hear about. It's noise. Forget it. Here's the things that are news. Here's why it's important. Here's how it relates to you.
Should be paying attention to this.
Here's the big picture thing. Yeah. She does lots of good stories as well. Like if there's important stuff that's happening, she'll do like a full post and do like a full write-up. And then she'll do like stories every day or if there's stuff that's like happening, like important stuff, she'll do one then and explain, like sort of break it all down. And she started doing the Instagram TV or whatever the hell that is.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
I don't understand.
Yeah, that's what that's what these talks are.
The stories.
Yeah. And and she's fantastic. And she's, I think she just wrote a book as well, but she's been a journalist for years in the States. Very similar vein. So I'm going to check yours out.
Yeah.
And, yeah. She's fantastic.
And it's like, yeah, she's talking about what Trump's doing, but then she's
and
also
the
being
like, and
like
all this
and she's
stuff,
like, but you know what? No one's talking about what NASA's doing. Or we need to, this has huge ramifications. Like these, all these little stories that you don't necessarily hear about because there's so much other fucked up stuff happening in the world that other potentially very important stories aren't being heard.
Yeah.
The news so outside of the sensationalized news.
Yeah. It's hard to
industrial
find.
Complex.
It's hard. Yeah. It's really
the
difficult
media industrial
to navigate.
Complex.
Yeah. Whatever it is. Yeah. On my phone through Instagram. Hi.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, it's great.
Good one.
And I will check out that other lady.
Yeah, I'm going to check out yours too. Well. And we'll link all of these on the old blogzy, the old webzy. Do you want to go or do you want me to go?
You go.
Okay. Mine is a complete diversion from this highbrow talk that we were talking about.
Oh, wow.
I don't know where else to find it, but it's on Crave in Canada. It's a Cinemax produced show that I've fallen in love with. My husband and I have been watching it to death, called Tales from the Tour Bus. Have you guys seen this?
No.
It's a Mike Judge show. There's two seasons.
Love him.
Love Mike Judge. If you don't know Mike Judge, King of the Hill and Office Space. Among many other
Silicon
things.
Valley.
Silicon Valley.
It's amazing.
It's so funny.
So Mike Judge is like the narrator and is an animated show, but it's like sort of rotoscoped. So it's like, basically it goes through, the first season is all about like country, like down home, old, like outlaws country. So they talk about Waylon Jennings and they talk about Tammy Wynette and George Jones and people that I generally, I'm not really interested in that music.
But the stories are great.
The stories are next level.
These are real life stories
told by real life people. So it's filmed. Rotoscope means it's filmed like live action and then it's animated over on top of it.
Yeah.
So they don't look exactly, it's not like a photograph animation. It's a King of the Hill style animation. So they're really, and it's all the real people telling these stories and they're animated to it. So it's just really, it's a really cool way to hear these great stories. And the way that he introduces the first season, which is all this like outlaw country, is he, at the time that he sort of started into this and was listening to like NWA and like gangster rap in the 90s and was really into it. Mm. And all of these guys are talking about how, the, you know, the hardcore their lives are and, you know, and then they're like, he's like, wait a minute, you guys should hear the shit that was happening in the 60s and the 70s
with these years ago
crazy rednecks and the drugs that they were doing, you wouldn't believe the guys that they've shot, you know? So that was sort of the jumping off point for the first season. And then the second season gets into funk and like George Clinton and the Funkadelics and Bootsy Collins and James Brown and Prince and Rick James.
There's a lot of meat on that bone.
Rick James, I did not know this. Rick James was in a band in Canada, in Toronto, in the 60s, whose name escapes me. It's like, I want to say the Yardbirds.
It's the Yardbirds. Somethings, probably.
It's that era.
It's a bird of some kind. But with guys like Neil Young, like he was writing music and singing songs Neil Young. He told Neil Young, you should try singing.
Ooh.
So and he's like, he was in that mix and then...
And then became Rick James
super freak. The story of Rick James is unbelievable. I had no idea. It's heartbreaking.
Fascinating.
So good. We burned through, I think we started watching this 4 days ago.
And
I think we have two episodes left in the second season. It's
Tales
fantastic. Tales from the Tour Bus. It's so funny.
The guys
are just telling their normal stories. Mike Judge sort of interjects as a narrator to like piece some things together. Yeah. The animation is great. Highly recommend. I don't know where you can watch it outside of Crave.
There's got to be
in Canada.
Else, sure.
Give it a Google. It'll pop up.
I'll figure it out.
There's some, maybe it's on Hulu in the States. I'm not sure. But
to know.
Very, very, very well done. Exciting. I really liked it. Yeah. And I don't give a shit about those like country stars. Like,
sure.
But the stories are next level.
That's interesting, the parallel between the rap and the country.
I know. Yeah. They're like, you should talk to these guys because these guys will shoot you. They'll straight up shoot you. Everyone here has shot a person.
I've heard arguments like of academic natures that rap music, especially gangster rap music, and country music are the two most authentic types of creative expression because they're actually singing about stuff that they are doing.
That they're living and doing, yeah.
As opposed to rock stars who just talk about their asses all the time.
Yeah. I would definitely.
So it's interesting that they're, you know,
lived experience.
That he saw that parallel.
They're singing about their real lives.
And
or
especially
about their real lives.
In as marginalized communities.
Yeah.
Because the guys, you know, Waylon Jennings did not come from wealth.
Fit in.
You know, those guys are not, they're not coming from the
poor
right side
folk.
Of the track.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They are some poor white folk. But anyway, highly recommend.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Very good.
We'll have to check that out.
Yeah. Evan, what are you at?
Kind of in the vein of what Abby has got is this amazing YouTube channel called Be Kind Rewind. And there are these amazing videos all centered around mostly the Best Actress Oscar. So this film critic, film studies, academic kind of contextualizes the climate, the social, political climate, the climate of Hollywood at that time and what that win kind of
means.
Represented
sure.
for that actress.
You were not the best actress, but at the time you were. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So basically, like, there's amazing ones about Liza Minnelli and Elizabeth Taylor and Audrey Hepburn.
Stuff.
And oh my God, I hate it so much.
Yeah,
completely disinterested.
Yeah, not up your alley at all.
dishing on
yeah,
and dishing on divas.
There's this great one about how Julie Andrews won for Mary Poppins and how she was passed over for the role of Eliza Doolittle in My Fair Lady because basically, what's the name of the guy?
Givenchy, who was designing
She was passed over for the role of Eliza Doolittle because the guy who ran the studio who made My Fair Lady, the movie musical, just didn't find her attractive.
Oh, she just had a personal subjective level. Just didn't like her face.
Even though she'd created the role on Broadway, won like so many awards for the role.
Whatever. Yeah.
Had,
but just wasn't.
Won the heart of the nation doing it on Broadway, enough. But wasn't good enough to be put into the picture. And then that's why Audrey Hepburn came in
and yada, yada, yada.
Who eventually was never nominated for an Oscar for the performance.
Yeah.
But Julie Andrews won for her role in Mary Poppins.
To make up for, well, people say the Glenn Close win was making up for all the other times she didn't win.
But she, and then she didn't win.
And then she didn't win.
Which is also a video on she contextualizes Glenn Close's career and how she's been passed over and over again because she's played roles that the Academy
don't feed into
doesn't
that.
Like to see. They don't like to see women playing...
Making trouble, basically.
Mm-hmm. Playing serial killer, or not like sociopaths and women in power, the femme fatale, you know? So, and there's probably one of the best ones she did was around Gwyneth Paltrow's Oscar win, and it brings in how Harvey Weinstein created the modern Oscar campaign, and how
and how
he fits into that whole thing.
And then there's a reel of people thanking Harvey Weinstein in their Oscars.
Oh, absolutely,
a running reel. There's probably like 15 prominent people.
Yes, I think I've seen a clip of that.
Yeah,
I think I've seen that one.
I've heard that rings a bell.
Yeah.
When Meryl Streep won her Oscar or won a Golden Globe, she referred to him as the monster.
Take that.
She was one of the few ones not to follow the script.
She's like the beast, Harvey Weinstein. Gotta thank you.
Made it happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's great. And they're like 10-15 minute videos, and she just does such a great, she goes and finds old newspaper clippings from like the 40s and 50s.
Sure, to create the story, to supplement all of this
and really brings you into like the studio system and how these actresses were kind of like, if you had two bad pictures, it didn't matter how talented you were. It didn't matter how much money you'd made for the studio. If you had two bad pictures, you were kind of thrown out.
Yeah.
You know?
I could see how you could spend an entire afternoon watching those.
Seriously. Yeah.
Even the ones with actresses I don't know, and movies I've never seen. Fascinating.
Still.
Cool. Yeah.
Highly recommend. Be Kind Rewind on YouTube.
Rewind.
I like that a lot.
Marvelous.
We covered a lot of ground.
Oh, aren't we smart?
Yeah.
Smart.
Sophisticated.
Oh, this was so much fun, guys.
Yes.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you enough for reaching out.
I know. We are so lucky to have had you available in the city, and we, like, all
just
the stars
aligned
that we could get together. It's been such a treat. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, guys. Keep doing what you're doing.
I was going to say, you keep it up, and we'll keep it up, and we'll keep in touch.
It's important work.
Yeah.
Happy to hear someone who's not the three of us say that.
Or someone that we're
married to. Or my mom, yeah.
Our moms.
Before we wrap this puppy up, where can we find you? Where can we find this Canadian Fashion Scholars Network? Where can I put some links out?
So the Canadian Fashion Scholars Network has its own website and Instagram account. So you can just Google that. And the books that I was talking about earlier, they're all available on Amazon. So if you Google Berlina Schick or Wiener Schick, which is the German name for Vienna.
Wiener Schick. It's always funny. I've been speaking German for 20 years. It's always funny.
It is.
It's like fart. Always funny. It means exit. Aus fart means exit.
Yep.
So there you go.
We went for a German meal last night. It was delicious. Oh, an authentic German house at the Alpenhaus.
In all of my years in Vancouver, I've never been.
Oof. It was good.
We should go. A good schnitzel.
Yeah, schnitzel.
Real with all the lemon and mayonnaise.
There's also Bauhaus in Gastown that does.
Yeah. I've been to Bestie and get the wiener and french fries because that's fucking delicious.
Oh, yeah.
The currywurst.
Bestie's really good.
Yeah. Shout out to Bauhaus.
Yeah. Good to know.
Montreal. So there's Montreal Chic that I that I wrote, so please look it up. And then the newest one that just came out that Susan and Marcus co-wrote is LA Chic. So yeah, excellent. All available on Amazon.
Are there more we'll put links coming out?
Hopefully. Right, we should have one on Vancouver. So
Detroit, you said, maybe?
Yeah, who knows? If there are people who are interested, they should look it
reach
up.
Out.
Reach out.
Yeah, excellent.
Speak up. Very cool.
There'll be links to all of those on the website.
On fashionhags.com or fashionhagspodcast.com.
Fashionhagspodcast.com, yeah. Thank you so much.
Yes.
Again. It's been such a treat.
So fun.
What was on air and what was off air has been a delight. An
absolute delight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you guys.
Yes. So
find us.
Yeah. Twitter, find us. Yeah.
Instagram.
All the places.
Yep. Email us, fashionhags@gmail.com.
Leave us a rating. We love that. Leave
five
us
stars
a
only.
Review. Yeah. That really makes a difference to where we land in the charts. So let's do that. And also just remember that we love you.
Oh, we love that.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.